I'll just do 10 seconds of silence or 5 seconds of silence so that Dave Downey knows where to edit. Good evening and welcome to episode 3 of Talking the Blues. We're hoping this week that actually this podcast will survive long enough for most of you to listen to it. Apologies for last week. We had technical problems, which I think I've done about 60-odd podcasts now, and it's never happened before. A couple of people who did listen to the first 5 to 6 minutes of last week's podcasts talked about or mentioned that they very much enjoyed listening to Andy talk about his experiences in ice hockey. Before that, very rude of me, I should have said good evening to both Andy and to George. Good evening, gents.
Hi, Paul.
Good evening.
Hi, Paul.
Evening. Evening. Right, Andy. You did talk, and it was very interesting. So perhaps I know there's a couple of other things that you want to pick up on that, but over to you on ice hockey brands and sort of, you know, your experiences in professional sports.
Right. Cheers, Paul. Well, I mean, what we talked about last time was the interview that Marcel Brand had done when he talked about needing to really research the character, etc. of players. And I've actually got these quotes in front of me where he says, the first step is the quality of the player and the positions. Well, that's a gimme. And then he says, if you think a player could really fit, then you have to look at all kinds of analysis, the physical aspect, the injury history, and you try to find out more about his character and background. You do your research around that particular player, and we have a very good department at Everton with young guys who are very interested in all the information and what they bring to my desk. We are sometimes surprised by what they produce. It's really good information. Well, that struck a note with me when I first read that interview, because when I was involved in professional ice hockey, that was exactly what we used to do. Now, obviously, putting a squad together in hockey is different because you've, in effect, you've got three or four teams in one, because you match players in offensive and defensive lines. So you've got two defensemen and three forwards, and that will form a five, but they don't stay as a rigid five. But you look at players positionally and for their qualities, because you grade them. If you've got six defensemen, you'll grade them from one through six. So naturally, your number one and two defensemen are getting on your top line. But the interesting thing was what he talked about with character and background. And one of the things we used to do, and we were very lucky in hockey, there was a global database of hockey players. And when I say global, I mean global. Just about anybody who picked up a stick and played hockey was on this database. And you could track them through the various teams they'd played, and you could see all the other players on the teams. So if we were looking at bringing a guy over to the UK from North America, or indeed from in Europe or Russia, we'd check him out. We'd check out what he was playing. If there was video footage, we'd see it and look at it and everything. But then we'd go into the research, and we would spend, and I do mean hours, hours and hours on the phone at night to North America or to Russia, talking with players they played with, players they played against, coaches who'd coached them, coaches who'd coached against them, and even general managers. I remember one night talking to the GM of the New York Rangers in the National Hockey League about a player who'd not made it to the NHL. And I rang this guy, and he was great. He spoke to me for about 20 minutes. He gave me the full lowdown on him from a general manager's perspective. And we did the deal and brought the guy in, and everything the everything that all the research we'd done panned out, but it took an enormous amount of time. But it's worth investing in that time in doing the research, not just looking at a piece of video footage and thinking, oh, he looks good, but finding out what they're like. What are they like off the ice or off the grass? What are they like with the rest of the squad when they're not training? Are they popular? Are they, you know, are they a bit quiet? Are they a bit up their own backside or whatever? And you talk to players and you talk to coaches, and the interesting thing is talking to coaches who coached against them and how they set their team up to nullify this particular player. And you got a, you then get a feeling of what the guy's true strengths and weaknesses are, because obviously, you know, you talk to the agent tells you he's the best player in the world, he's a great team guy, he's never any trouble, blah, 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 blah. And then you, you bring them over and you find out that they're completely high maintenance guys, and you get them on a plane and get them out of the place as quick as you can. So what Brands was talking about really struck a chord with me. And I'm thinking, if he's doing that kind of research into players to join Everton in the future, then all power to him, because that's exactly the right thing to be doing. And I genuinely, after the hours and hours that I used to spend on the phone in the middle of the night, my missus used to think I'd left home. And I was getting to bed at 4 o'clock in the morning. I've been spent 2 or 3 hours on the phone at night.
Talking.
Transatlantic. Pardon?
Talking Russian.
Talking. Every now and again, the odd phrase would come in, our kid, yeah. But it, what I'm trying to highlight is what he said in that interview is exactly what Everton need to be doing. We've got to get better and better and better at the way we recruit. Good players aren't enough. You've got to have a good character. And a coach that I worked with for 4 years in the UK once said to me, he would take a little less to get a lot more. And what he meant by that was he would take a little less skill if he was getting a better character. And if he could build, if he could bring a guy in who would gel with the rest of the squad, because you're talking a hockey squad of 22 players who might all get on the ice at any one, not any one time, but through the course of a game. These guys had to be able to play with one another in different positions and in different formations. It's different in football. You've got 11 guys out there and you've only got three more, a maximum, who can come on. But the need to get players who can gel with one another is absolutely paramount. Absolutely. It's you know, it's, it was music to my ears when, or music to my eyes when I read what Marcel Brands had said. But taking it on another stage, if I can, it got me thinking, and looking at the last couple of games we've played where, you know, we beat Chelsea thoroughly deservedly. Something that whatever Marco Silva said at half-time against Chelsea worked perfectly because we blew them away second half. We went to West Ham and completely dominated that game. Embarrassing that for West Ham that we didn't actually put 5 or 6 goals past them. And then we did a similar job on Arsenal without enforcing or endorsing the domination with more goals. And then we go and fail miserably at Fulham. And you think to yourself, why? What's gone on? What's wrong with the mindset? Because people on the internet are saying, oh, Everton have just Evertoned the Fulham game. A team relegated, winless in 9 or something like that. Haven't kept a clean sheet since Adam was a lad. Everton are on a 3-game winning streak, haven't conceded a goal, and we go and blow it. What is wrong with the mindset? And that got me thinking again over the weekend, and it reminded me, and I can't remember where it was. It was either in Sweden or in the Czech Republic when we went to Prague twice and beat Sparta Prague. But I got talking to a coach, and he told me one of the things he used to do. And I just want to relate this to you. And what he told me was that at the end of the last training session before what was normally a 2-game weekend, because in hockey you play home and away generally on a weekend. But at the end of the last training session, when the guys were all back in the changing room, the coach would get one player to stand up in front of the rest of the team and talk about their career to date. And it was largely done to help those guys who were shy of talking, if you like, publicly. Nobody's shy of talking in the locker room normally, but to actually stand up and talk to 20 other people sometimes takes a bit more confidence than just chin wagging while you sat there getting changed. And he would get them to stand up, to give a bit of confidence and talk about their career to date. And he told me that invariably the rest of the room fell totally silent and listened. Then when the guy's finished, the coach would then ask the player to commit to do one thing in that weekend's games that they will do for their mates. And then after the games, the squad then thank them for what they did, if they did it, which of course they did, because they didn't want to let their mates down. And then it got me thinking, you look at Everton at Fulham, and in far, far, far too many games in recent seasons, and I just got to thinking, do these guys know each other? Do they talk to each other? They looked like they'd never played together before.
Definitely.
They were on the same page.
Let's bring George in, Andy, because George sent me a very amusing email not long after the end of the Fulham game. George, what were your thoughts? your polite ones.
My take on it was that everybody in Everton knows that the back line is Coleman, Keane, Zouma, stroke Mina, Digne. And Jags did wonderfully well against Arsenal. But when he picks the same team, when he goes, never change a winning team, and you know they lost their last nine games in a row, we'll give Jags another run out. I don't believe it's not possible that every single member of the squad, however subconsciously, went, oh, all right, oh, it's not that serious then, because. I'm not even going to bet you on this one. When we tip up against United, Jags won't be playing centre-half. And not because he had a poor game against Mitrovic, he would have given anybody a poor game, but because he shouldn't be there. He's not the number one. And if the manager is picking someone who's not the number one, I wasn't altogether surprised to find the other players going, oh, all right, well, we'll go on then, we'll phone this one in, shall we? Because it's not important. And that's what I watched. And, you know, my take on it, as I said to Andy after the match, is that they were disrespectful of Fulham, of themselves, which is the root of what Andy's talking about, I think, which is team building. And worst of all, disrespectful to the fans. I was absolutely appalled. And then, you know, like you've said, Andy, you think back to the Wolves game when they just capitulated. And they've lost 15, 14 games this season. And some of them, they didn't even tip up. That was a shoddy, shoddy display on Saturday. Really poor. I was ashamed.
Andy, what do you think about the... I mean, I agree totally with what George has just said. And I think you make a very interesting point about the selection of Jagielka subconsciously sends out a message in terms of how important this game is or not to everybody. Andy, what about the ability to change things at half time? Because you know this would have been the classic poor performance in the first half, and they come out and you know they've been yelled at for the last 10 minutes at half time. We didn't see any of that, did we?
Not at all. And I think when I was writing the match report for Grand Old Team, I think I put a comment at the end of the first half. If a headmaster was writing a report on that, it would be must do better. And that Silva couldn't have been happy at what he'd watched. But whatever he said in the dressing room at Fulham had nothing like the effect of whatever he said against Chelsea worked. It, dare I suggest it was a David Moyes talk because it put them to sleep because they came out, coughed the ball up and Fulham went and scored straight away. I couldn't believe my eyes. It was ridiculous. And even then, okay, so we concede the early goal. We've got 44 minutes
to get
it back. Well,
that brings you to how many games have we won from going behind?
None. Yeah. None this season. We've taken three points from losing positions, three draws, 14 losses.
You know, do you want to go into an analysis of what we think that means? Paul, what's your take on what you saw?
I think Fulham played well to begin with. I think
they did.
I think tactically they were pretty sound. I mean, they matched up sort of identical formation to us. They tried to double up on Gomez when they had the chance to do so. But you know, none of that none of that should have really mattered, because, you know, coming off nine successive defeats as Fulham had, and us coming off, you know, a number of very, very good three wins and a number of very, very good performances, you know, we should have done what we did against Arsenal, which is in the first 10 minutes, press the living daylights out of them, dominate the game, hopefully get an early goal. And from that, then everything else should have flowed. But we didn't. We did what we did on so many, we've done on so many occasions this season. We sat back. We didn't get tight to anybody. We didn't defend high up the pitch. And we just made it extraordinarily easy for Fulham to attack in between the lines, which is what they did. And it, you know, it comes back to, and there's nothing original in this, I suppose, lack of leadership on the pitch. You know, there wasn't a Peter Reid type character to go around and say, you know, what the hell's going on here? We just played very well against Arsenal last week, and yet here we are at Fulham, and you know, we reverted back to how we were in January. There didn't seem to be any of that. And that's what really puzzles me. It puzzles me generally in sport when people don't perform to the levels that they can do. And George, I'm going to ask you a question in a minute about in acting and in terms of your career, whether this happens. See, I start from the principle that anybody who's a Premier League footballer is by definition a winner, because they've come through thousands and thousands and thousands of people to get to the position where they're at. So, you know, if every Premier League team has a squad of 25, there's only 500 Premier League footballers at any one time.
Yeah.
And that those 500 are, you know, at the top, very top of the pyramid. The pyramid below is massive. So why is it that they can't perform, you know, week in, week out at or near the highest levels? And George, does that happen in your business? Because the people that you act with, they're all at the top of their game, aren't they? One would assume.
You know, you're flattering me, but yes, generally that's true. But what the facts of the matter is, let's say I started rehearsal on this show today in Edinburgh, and we will do 38 shows, like Everton will play 38 games next season in the Premiership. Now, one of those shows, one of those performances by Everton will be the best. One of them, like it or lump it, will be the worst. There's nothing you can do. That's just a fact of life. But the job of being a professional actor is to make the gap between the worst performance you do and the best performance you do as small as possible. That you keep to a very consistent level. And on that, in those terms, Everton are failing badly, I think.
Yeah. George? Andy.
I don't disagree. I don't disagree. And funnily enough, while you were talking, Paul, I just pulled up, because you mentioned the lack of leadership, and I don't want this to sound like I'm having a go at Phil Jagielka, but I've just pulled up his quotes after the game at Fulham, where he said, "We'll dust ourselves down and look forward to the United game, and hopefully put in a similar performance to our recent ones at home. Against Fulham, we didn't have a great start and we didn't get back to our levels. They came out of the blocks fast, like we were expecting. They were at home, and with the relegation, I think it freed them up a little bit. We just didn't get any momentum in the game." Those quotes staggered me. Hopefully we'll put in a similar performance to recent ones when we play United. And Fulham came out of the blocks fast, like we were expecting. Well, if they were expecting it, why the hell weren't they able to counter it? I find those quotes bizarre. There's not a winning mentality there. There's no leadership mentality there. I'd actually have preferred it if Jags had came out and said, "I'm really sorry, folks, but we stunk the place out. We were goddamn awful, and rest assured, it sure as hell ain't going to happen again on my watch." But you don't get that from anyone within Everton.
Hard to argue.
Too many soft words. Too many soundbite quotes. It's like, you know, you know, professional sportsmen sometimes switch into media mode where it's like they've got a tape recorder in the back of the head. And depending on the question, different section of tape plays.
Because that would be fine because that's just part of their job. But what we're really talking about is doing the job on the pitch. You know, some people are good with cameras and microphones and things, and some people are not. I don't mind what's said afterwards, but what, because, you know, it was patently obvious from watching it that there was just no cohesion there at all. And then you get, you know, nasty incidents like Gomez, which is, an expression, one presumes, of deep frustration with the way the whole afternoon's gone.
Well, it's an expensive sign of frustration because he's had a ban. Three games,
well,
I think.
He's got up till tomorrow evening to either accept the ban or to challenge it. So,
all right. So it's a potential.
Yeah, but
three games.
If it was for dangerous play, it's definitely for three games. So. That's effectively his season over.
Well, you would have to say it was dangerous play, and he'd be a mug to challenge it, wouldn't he?
You'd think so. I mean, personally, I thought it was indefensible. I don't want any player to do that, let alone an Everton player.
That was horrible, and it was also horrible that the manager ducked it as well.
Well, that brings me on to another thing then.
Go on then, Andy, go on.
Marco Silva ducked it. And for years, we've had managers who, they only get one chance to see it at game speed. They generally don't get to see a replay before they're interviewed 5 minutes after the game. But how many times have we heard managers say, "I didn't see it," about incidents? Arsene Wenger, you know, bless him, was famous for it. And on Saturday, when Marco Silva was interviewed about the Gomez challenge, he swerved the question and launched into almost a tirade on Fulham and their physios constantly invading the pitch to offer treatment, breaking up the flow of the game. And it's like, okay, so Fulham's starting to slow the game down. But he was asked about, you know, a very, very poor challenge by Andre Gomez on Mitrovic. And when are we going to get a manager to own up and say, "I didn't see it, but I'm going to watch it on replay. And if it's as bad as people say it is, I will deal with it"? We don't. You don't hear it. And it's poor. You know, when is somebody going to actually stand up and take account? You know, Jag saying hopefully we'll put a similar performance in against United. I don't want hopefully. I want goddamned assurance that we're going to see a better performance. And I'd like to see a manager be totally honest about serious foul play.
No doubt about it, Andy. You're right. I mean, you know, we could talk about this for a long time, I suppose. It does seem that we've still got this enormous soft centre, you know, within the club, where we won't challenge behaviour that's wrong, or where we don't expect people to want the very best week in, week out. I thought DCL's contribution at the weekend was very telling. After, you know, a couple of really good performances, if we can just move the conversation on a little bit, he didn't quite he certainly didn't do the pressing job that he did against Arsenal. And you'd have thought Fulham would have presented a better opportunity to do that. He didn't do that. But also, I think, you know, and again, without being overly critical of the lad, he sort of demonstrated as much as he demonstrated some strengths last week against Arsenal, he demonstrated the weaknesses in his game, I thought, this weekend, with his inability either to arrive in the six-yard box at the right time. I'm thinking about in the first half, where it crossed from the right hand side. I think it was Coleman that crossed it.
Just before half time.
He dived at it very late, and I think he sort of glanced it, didn't he? But I mean, really, that was a goal. You know, it was an opportunity that he should have scored. And of course, the one that just flicked the post in the second half. What I mean, you two have both seen, as I have both seen some of Everton's greatest number nines. Is he a number nine? What should we do with him?
Blimey.
I like asking you difficult questions.
I said to Andy after the match, and if next week against United you could pick DCL or Mitrovic, who would you pick? And, you know, on that cold, hard level, No, he's not yet a number nine. And against Mitrovic's performance that we all saw, because we're all Evertonians, he's not in the same ballpark. But he could be. But, you know, that would depend on how much, you know, it's just a shame we haven't got Marcel Brands here to tell us why they're going to give that boy a lot of time, which I hope they can. But, you know, we would be a lot further up the league if we, you know, if we had someone who could put the ball in the net much more regularly than he can at the moment.
And probably, again, with no offence to DCL, because I like the lad, I really do, but he doesn't strike fear into opposing centre-backs, whereas Mitrovic most definitely had Jags and Zouma backpedalling most of the game. And he's playing with a side that's got relegated. So, you know, DCL, he's got the size, but he hasn't got the presence. He's got the physical size, but he's not got the physical presence yet.
Well, it'll be a question of whether
that,
they
I think,
wait
is the big
it.
Question. On
it'll be a
on,
question of whether in the shopping over the summer, whether they go, no, we'll wait for this to happen. Because I think it will happen. He's, you know, his heart and soul's in the right place. But you're right, Paul. You know, but you know, last week you were talking about how Sigurdsson does a load of closing down. I didn't see Sigurdsson do anything on Saturday at all.
I don't think he got off the coach, did he?
Just that one ball for DCL.
Yeah,
when he hit
the ball
post,
inside. You know, just going before we talk about Sigurdsson. Just going back to DCL. I can't say who it was. But somebody in the club said to me prior to Saturday's game, and I'm sure it hasn't changed despite his performance on Saturday, is that they see a huge future in DCL. That they don't, and I don't think from the comments that were made that they're in the market for another number nine this season. I think they recognise that he doesn't yet score a number of goals that he should. But the comment that was made to me is, you know, if look at Harry Kane's performance in the first two or three years when he first broke through, both with Tottenham and Norwich, and you know, he didn't score many goals. I mean, he then went on obviously to score a lot of goals very, very quickly. But I think I'm not saying necessarily that they are comparing him directly with Harry Kane, or they expect him to perform the way that Harry Kane has. But I think they do.
I do think
they see an awful lot in him.
Well, the best you could say about DCL, a wonderful thing to say about anybody in any walk of life, he's getting better.
Yeah, I think he is. I think the interesting thing will be to see if he bulks up a bit in the summer, see where his physique is. Come the start of next season, because I just think he needs to be a bit more physical in his play. Not dirty, not rough, but centre halves need to know that they've had, you know, that they've earned their money when they've played against Dominic Calvert-Lewin in a blue shirt.
They need to be coming off the pitch, black and blue. Arsenal centre halves.
He did, but and there's the thing about consistency. He didn't do it at Fulham, whereas he did it against Arsenal. So they need to find a way, whether it's mental or physical or whatever, of getting that level of consistency up, so that he's not up one week and down the next. Like you said, you've got to close the gap between your best performance and your worst performance. Well, if Arsenal was his best, Fulham was one of his worst. So they've got to find a way to close that gap, preferably much nearer the better end of the market.
Andy, you know, on the point of him bulking up, I sometimes wonder about that. I wonder if it's not technique as much as physical size and presence. If you think of somebody like Tim Cahill never weighed more than 68 kilos when he played for Everton. Yet he could bully and harass, you know, the biggest and the best, not necessarily all through the game, every game. But, you know, there were days when he could take on people 6 inches taller than him and probably 20 kilos heavier than him and leave them floundering. So I just wonder whether it's not necessarily just, obviously, the heavier you are, the greater the advantage. But I wonder if there's not technique to it. And I suppose that brings the question that, you know, sort of divides Evertonians. I mean, who's coaching DCL? Is it Duncan Ferguson?
You would imagine that it should be, you know, centre forward. It would be a bit bizarre if somebody else was doing it, wouldn't it?
Well, then.
I totally agree.
What, you totally agree that it should be him? Or?
I agree that if Ferguson isn't coaching DCL, then what's he doing there in the first place with a coach's uniform on? And secondly, who is coaching DCL? The common sense would say that, as George said, a former centre forward coaches a centre forward. But you don't see, or you see very little of any Ferguson DCL trait in the DCL.
Exactly my point. His first touch has got better this season. And it used to be a clearance, and it's not. Yep. He's got better, and he's got, I don't know, you know, if what you've heard from within the club is sound, Paul, then, you know, we should drop the conversation. We're going to persist with him. Good luck to the lad. Hope he sucks up the confidence in spades.
Yeah, totally agree. Totally agree. Get behind the boy. Support him.
Yeah. We're just three guys having a chat, but there are still clearly questions to be asked and answered with regards to him, although clearly the club have a huge amount of confidence in him. I would ask the question, okay, if one assumes that the club think he's got the ability and that he will develop into, you know, a very good Premier League number nine, who's going to get him there? And I, you know, this is a personal comment of mine. I don't know Duncan Ferguson. I don't know what he does necessarily as a coach, but from my perspective, I would like to see better coaching in that position.
Mm-hmm.
I've
had similar thoughts myself, Paul, because, you know, he was there when we had Lukaku, and Lukaku's a totally different animal to DCL, both physically and, dare I say, mentally. But Lukaku just seems to be a natural athlete, because in the warm-ups, He never broke sweat in the warm-up, and sometimes he didn't break sweat in the games, but he had that knack and technique of hitting the onion bag regularly. But I don't know. Duncan Ferguson as a coach is sometimes bewilders me, and I hope I'm not doing him a terrible disservice, but I think I'm with you. I don't genuinely see any genuine sign that the Duncan Ferguson as a player is being translated into, you know, his long-term replacement.
From my perspective, and George, would be interested in your view on this, you'd expect him to, you know, and Duncan Ferguson to concentrate his activities on DCL, because obviously that's the most like-for-like individual and position. But you'd also expect if we got a member of the coaching team who was recognised as a decent goal scorer, as a natural goal scorer, you'd also expect across the team for there to be an improvement in individual players' goal scoring abilities. And I've been thinking about this for a while, and I'm struggling to think of somebody in the side whose goal scoring capabilities have improved in the last few years.
Oh, blimey.
Sorry, I should have forewarned you of this question.
Yeah, I think
maybe
we
can come back, to that next week and think about it. But, you know, people who've like developed through the team, and it's clearly players have developed over recent years, even though we haven't performed well as a team. You know, individuals have got, you know, have become better footballers. And one of the big things about Marco is that he is supposed to be able to develop players, and players like being coached by him. And I remember Keith Harris saying to me that, you know, one of the things that they really liked about him when he joined the club was his ability to improve players. But if you break down where those improvements are, and you can say, you know, some people have become better defenders, some people have become better midfielders. Garner Gay, for example, you could say is a better midfielder now than when he joined the club. But can we really think of anybody in the last sort of, well, probably since Martinez left, or even before, who has become a better goal scorer at Everton than they were elsewhere previously? Take Lukaku out of the equation for a second.
Obviously, Richarlison has scored more goals for us than he did for Watford, and I don't remember Sigurdsson getting 13 goals in a season for Swansea. That's or a fair Spurs. Point. But the bones of your point remains, I think. I don't know, you see, because, you know, I heard from someone sort of inside the club when Koeman took over, and I said, well, you know, what's the buzz? And she said, this person said, the players hate him. He's just you know, it must be so, if I'm in a show where you hate the director and, you know, you just don't feel up to, you just wait for it to all end, really. And then you've got Sam and Vlasic, you know, who, you know, you thought, well, you know, your point a minute ago, Andy, about why don't people stand up and say it like it is. And Vlasic goes, the football we played under that man was horrible. And we all went, get him back. You know, sorry, Nicola, have a shirt look. So I think, you know, the atmosphere has not been there at Goodison for players to improve. And that's why a season that now goes something like we've won 14, drawn two, and lost 14 is not what you were kind of hoping for. You were hoping for something better. I think probably, you know, the way Silva talks to the players, you know, there was a fantastic couple of seconds of telly as he got hold of Gomez and he's going, ah! And he's obviously passionate about what he's saying. You know, but I don't, because it's a competitive game, you know, it's a competitive sport, and they just got outdone even on Saturday against a team they should have trolleyed. There are so many components to the atmosphere that might make a player improve. And having said all that waffle, my mind goes to Bernard, who has consistently improved game on, game on, game on, every game this season. And is now playing with Digne better than he's played, you know, better than we could have hoped. He looks like a very dangerous customer. That one moment where he went into the centre and ran at their defence, she thought, yes, that's a good idea. Let's have more of that. As regards putting the ball in the net, you know,
possibly it's slightly unfairly given he didn't have very, you know, a long time to stamp his name on the game. But Luckman didn't pull up any trees, did he?
I was just going to say, you know, I know our kid's a big exponent of Ademola Lookman, but when you've got Bernard playing as well as he is, if Bernard starts to add goals to his game, Lookman is going to get even less of a chance. You know, Bernard looks the real deal. He just needs eight to ten goals a season. You know, the way, you know, Trevor Stephen and Sheedy used to chip in from wide positions with goals, coming inside and scoring. You know, if he adds goals to his game, Luckman is going to be on very reduced game time, and he's not getting a lot now.
It's a real mystery, isn't it, over Luckman?
Luckman, yeah, I am. But, it is. You know, if you don't
George,
play the boy,
you're probably, of the three of us, you're probably his biggest fan.
If you don't play him, you're talking about how do they improve. They can't improve. You're not on the pitch, you can't improve. DCL is a classic example of, right, son, you can make mistakes. I'm going to give you the shirt. Go with it. And he has got better. No question about that. And I believe, and so has Bernard. I suspect that Luckman might be on his way, because if I was his agent, I'd be going, come on, son. Do you want to play this game? You're 22 now. These lot don't trust you. And they may be right too. I don't know. You know, but you're right. He didn't pull up any trees. He had 20 minutes and he didn't, you know, he got bullied as well. I'm afraid they were.
I think that we were second best in just about every department on Saturday at Fulham, which is even more bizarre given how they've played all season. But Saturday was just unreal at times.
How frustrating will it be if we turn up against United? Obviously, we want to, but it will be hugely frustrating if we
It will, Paul. You're absolutely right. If they come out on Sunday at lunchtime and give United a really good game and hopefully come out of it with 3 points, it will double the frustration of Fulham. You know, it won't wash it away. It won't whitewash over it. It'll just make you think, hang on a minute, we've now beaten Chelsea, Arsenal, and with a bit of luck, we beat United. What the hell happened? It just magnifies the nonsense that went on at Craven Cottage and the poor manner that they went about things and their inability to change that game, even at half time, never mind after they'd gone a goal down. Why didn't they all come out pumped up? I don't know. It just frustrates me. What is it with, is there a mental blockage somewhere within Everton? I don't know. Game preparation, game adjustment. We didn't.
It's all gone quiet.
The game preparation didn't look to have gone very well, and there was no sign of game adjustment.
No, I'm with you. Now, perhaps for a couple of minutes, we can talk about your favourite team, given that we're playing them next, Manchester United. For both of you,
we've got to beat them on Sunday.
One. I guess one of the advantages of this podcast
as
is
regards,
that we've got sort of, you know, a book of
Fulham lying
games
around
that we've
on the
been
pitch,
to and experiences
talk,
that we've had over the years,
stop all that
like
behavior
many
too.
Other Evertonians. What's your favourite United game?
Oh, I can bet what our kid will say about that.
Well, George has disappeared. Hopefully, he'll come back in a second.
Has he gone?
I think we mentioned mentioning the word Manchester United, he's disappeared.
I suppose the obvious one in recent times was the cup semi-final when we beat them at Wembley with the penalty shootout.
He's back.
For me, there was a League Cup tie in the 70s when we went there and beat them 3-0. In the League Cup. I'll never forget it because Tommy Docherty got me the tickets for the game. It was great. And we went on a Wednesday night and battered them. That one sticks long in the memory. People obviously say the Oviedo game under Martinez was one to remember. I was in Accra in Ghana the night of that game, watching it in a pub. That was good fun. I'm trying to think of other. I mean, the 3-1 game at Goodison when Billy Legdanov scored and left Van der Sar rooted to his line, an absolutely stonking goal from Dinyar Billy Legdanov. That was another one that sticks in the memory.
What about yours, George?
Unfortunately, with you,
George,
is he not back?
It says he's back, but it doesn't sound like he is. Talking the Blues.
You can tell this is live, can't you?
yet again. All right, look.
I would wave. Is he back? No, I would wager he would go with the Cup semi-final at Burnden Park in 66. I would wager that. So if he comes back, that's my guess that he's going to say it was one of his best games against United.
Were you at that game?
No, I wasn't. I was a mere 10 years old, and at that time, but I mean, I'd been to Burnden many yeah. times as a kid because our eldest brother was a Bolton fan, and George was in his early days as well, for a while until he saw the light. But no, I was only 10 back then, and 60 odd thousand people at Burnden Park. I think my mum and dad would have had a fit if I'd have gone to that.
I know that my granddad went. I think I would have been about 3 or 4 at the time, so I certainly didn't go. But I recall my granddad, or I know of the fact that my granddad went to that. I suppose for me, the favourite United game was the 5-0.
Oh, of course. I wasn't at that one because it was two weekends, wasn't it? They beat United 5-0 yep. and then Liverpool. And we were on holiday that week, and driving down to Cornwall, we had the United game on, and driving back, we had the Liverpool game on the radio. So I had live commentary on both games, but I had to wait for match of the day to actually see them. But yeah, that 5-0 was tasty.
That was 1984, wasn't it? From memory. It was the leading team. It was the winning team.
It would be 84.
85, yeah. Yeah. George Ealers.
Yeah. He's just texted me.
Well, apologies to everybody. Apologies to everybody who's tuned in to listen to George rather than me and Andy.
Oh, dear me. I can think of another United game that he'd like, and that was the the start of the, let me think, it would be 67-68 season. And they played United on the opening day of the season. And Alec Young scored an absolutely beautiful goal at the Park End. Left Nobby Styles, Nobby Styles on his backside with a shake of his hips.
I've seen
and then lashed it into the top corner past Alex Stepney.
From the old Goodison Road stand, the main stand side, there's a video of it, isn't there? That was a fantastic goal.
Yeah. Yeah. Fantastic goal. Now, I would wager our kid would, if he ever gets
George
back on this podcast,
away, but
remember that one
for some reason.
And the Cup semi-final in 66 at Burnden. He's just typing me another text message.
And
he says,
he's
keep
just,
going, but I can't join
again.
You seemingly. Don't know why I didn't touch anything.
All right. Well, look, we've got probably five to ten minutes.
We'll have to get his reminiscences at another time.
You and I can continue with it. One of the topics I know that we wanted to talk about was the introduction of VAR. And I don't know if you want to talk about that first, Andy, and then I'll chip in a bit as we go along.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Paul. One of the things that gets me about VAR, or that might get me about VAR, might get all of us, is who's actually making the decisions and where are they? Because there was an interesting comment on one of the games the other night where VAR was in use, and they said, and I quote, whoever it was is outside in the truck. So they're outside, they've got multiple camera angles, obviously, because they're picking it up from the TV feed, and they're watching it from every angle possible before relaying back to the referee. And it just made me wonder, is it just one person in the TV truck, or is it a panel of people, and there's maybe three or four reviewing it. And if I can just relate it back to, again, and I hope I'm not boring people by going back to ice hockey, but when I've been to the NHL in North America, and situations that need video assisted referee, they're not done by someone in a TV truck outside the stadium or outside the arena. They're all beamed back to NHL headquarters in Manhattan. And there's a people are sat there watching every single game on multiple TV sets, and they do the review totally remotely from the game where it physically is taking place. It could be out in California, or it could be in the west coast of Canada, in Vancouver or somewhere like that, or down in Florida. But all the VAR decisions are made totally remotely. And I just wondered whether football in Europe and B now in the UK are going to consider that, rather than having one individual sat in the truck making the decision for the referee.
It's an interesting point you make, isn't it? Whether or not the
or confirming
people who are
going to
make the decisions. First of all, how
I
many,
just think there's a bit of a grey area there.
And then secondly, whether or not they have to be present at the stadium, albeit, you know, in a separate area, and maybe in a truck outside, because there's no logical reason for them to be at the ground itself. One would think that if they were away from the ground in a central studio where, as you say, there's a bank of maybe 30 or 40 screens covering half a dozen games, perhaps, because it's probably never more than half a dozen games apart from last game of the season, or maybe Boxing Day where playing simultaneously. Mm-hmm. It's not a point I'd ever considered, but now that you mention it, it makes perfect sense to have it done remotely. It doesn't also. Yeah.
Mm. It certainly works. It works in North America, Paul, because it's employed in the NHL, in the NFL. You know, it all goes back to, if you like, the game's headquarters. And the judgment is made there by
the VAR reviewers make a decision, let's say, who's going to change week in, week out,
wherever the games
is
are.
Is it their decision that takes precedence over the referee, or how does that work?
If they deem that the referee has got the call wrong, I mean, by and large in hockey, it's about whether the puck has crossed the goal line, or that's 99% of the decisions by VAR in hockey are over goals, not foul play or penalty incidents, because you've got two referees in hockey and two linesmen. So, by and large, the officials on the ice make 99.9% of the decisions and get them right. That's the other thing. They very, very rarely get things wrong. But VAR comes in for goal line decisions. And if necessary.
And so, how does that happen? Do they have an earpiece go back to the referee and say,
headquarters
like they do
will
in cricket,
overturn a referee's
have to,
decision?
Alter your decision.
He's got it wrong.
You make a sign or you blow a whistle and you alter your decision accordingly. Is that how it works? It's not like up on a big screen.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, no, it's generally not on a big screen, but the referee will go over to the timekeeper's bench, and the timekeeper will hand him a headset, and he's then talking to NHL headquarters in Manhattan. They'll review it and say goal or no goal, and the referee will then just points to he either points to the goal for a face-off or he points to the centre circle to signify a goal. And that's the end of it. You know, the players might not like it, but as in rugby union and rugby league, referees in ice hockey are largely treated like pregnant women. You don't touch them and you don't abuse them. Otherwise, you're going for an early bath.
Right next door to opposing managers in order to make a decision or in order to hear a decision. Right.
No, he'll get told that the play has been reviewed and the decision from headquarters is X, and then he'll indicate that to the players, and he'll explain it to the coaches if he feels it's necessary. But by and large, once that decision's made,
let's just everybody try accepts one more time.
That it isn't going to get reversed, no matter how much they whinge. So they just get on with the game.
No, he is not. Okay. Yeah.
Apparently not. Can we stay on VAR for a minute, Paul? Because the other thing there was an interesting video of a football referee in Australia who was mic'd up like they are in rugby union and rugby league, and you could hear him talking to the players during the game, and I just thought, you know, if we bring in VAR in as we are next season, are the referees going to be mic'd up so that we can hear the discussion between them and the video assisted referee, and furthermore, how he explains it to the players? Because I think it would be good, as in rugby union and rugby league, that we can hear those discussions and we can hear those decisions articulated to the players.
Yeah.
And actually, if the referees are mic'd up, it would be a covert method of curbing bad language from the players. Because you don't hear rugby union players and rugby league players effing and jeffing at their referees, because A, they're going to lose 10 yards, and B, they might just go straight off the field. But in football, it's patently obvious that the amount of bad language is unacceptable. And I think if referees were mic'd up,
we might
see a reduction in bad language and a reduction in histrionics as well. Then there's that's the simplest way, because, you know, we've had codes of conduct and things like that, and, you know, there's been numerous instances of players going berserk in front of referees. And I just think if that referee's mic'd up and the whole of the viewing audience can hear somebody going off on one,
I agree.
It's going to stop in a heartbeat, particularly if referees then use the power they've got now and brandish cards.
Sorry to our audience, one for missing George and two for having a running commentary from us as to where
which
you might or might not be. Hey ho, it does prove it's alive, and no doubt one day we'll get through a podcast without there being any technical issues, but in the meantime,
it's live,
I hope it hasn't stopped people from enjoying what we've been talking about. I think to finish, Andy, and I don't know if you want to add any comments yourself, but today being April the 15th, and April the 15th, 2019, we're all aware very much that it's 30 years since the Hillsborough disaster. We're aware, obviously, that we can't say too much about the events of the day for legal reasons, which we will obviously respect. But the day and the date doesn't get any easier as the years go by. From my perspective, we were talking earlier, before we started the podcast, we were at, Villa Park, and we obviously knew something had gone on, although we didn't know the full extent of it until much later in the day on the journey home. And the overriding, emotion at the time was obviously fear for people that we knew, fear for loved ones in many cases. But also a recognition that it could have been us, and it was the toss of a coin that determined whether it was us or them.
Absolutely, Paul. I mean, I remember being at Villa Park that day with a good friend, Steve, and his brother Peter was a Red. Still is a Red, I should say. Peter was at Hillsborough and thankfully didn't get injured or hurt in any way in the Leppings Lane disaster. The thing I remember, obviously, was we knew that the game had been delayed and then abandoned, but we didn't know why. And leaving the ground and people leaving Villa Park and walking back to the car park and the coaches and everything, because we went by car, and people were coming out of the houses saying there's been a disaster at Hillsborough. Fences have come down, people have been crushed, and this, that, and the other. And all the way home from Villa Park, we pulled off the motorway at every service area so that Steve could ring home to see if his mum and dad had heard from Peter. And the queues of Blues on the way home at the phone boxes at Hilton Park, Kiel, Sandbach, Knutsford, it was astonishing to see the queues of people. Everyone wanted to know whether their mates, their families who were of the red persuasion had been involved. It was, and for me, as a Mancunian, you know, I'm not born and bred in Liverpool. I'm born and bred in Manchester and raised in Salford. And sometimes I do feel a little bit remote from it. But
no, they won't, said, Andy, Paul, unfortunately.
That day and those horrendous scenes.
From my perspective, the only thing I'd like to say is that
any of us,
from that terrible disaster, some good came about. It sounds strange to say this, but the goodness is that the city united around the disaster, and we are a city today that's still united in grief as to what happened on those days. And I, for one, although pride shouldn't necessarily be the right emotion, I'm very proud of the people of Liverpool, very proud of the people of Everton for the support that they gave the people of Liverpool and for how that's been accepted over the years. I think it does the city enormous credit. It's obviously, it's an enormous.
Totally endorse that. Totally endorse that. And I know from a lot of my friends who are, obviously, like I said, I'm from Manchester. Most of my friends, outside of my Everton friends, are United fans, and they feel exactly the same way. They genuinely do. That they, you know, that, you know, but for the grace of God, that could have been any two other teams and any other set of fans involved, and just you never ever
To be honest, I don't think we should say much more about it. I think we should just remember those that did pass away on the day. Remember those that are still affected to this day by the events of that day. People today are suffering as much today as they did 30 years ago. The lasting memory for me, and it's how I'm going to finish this podcast, if you don't mind, is Peter Jones, the BBC radio commentator, and his final words in the final report of the evening. And I think I'd just like to say that as the end of this podcast. He said, "The sun shines now." Okay, that's finished. Thanks for that.